Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Simon Schuster, John Roering, Jacob Kanzler, and Abigail Walls. A little later, Scott Hagerstrom is going to be joining us via telephone. He is in Cleveland for the run-up of the Republican National Convention. He is part of one of the four committees that is meeting before this convention. He is not part of the platform committee, but we're going to talk about those committees and Donald Trump here in just a minute. This past week, as much as we try to avoid it, and I don't know if we're necessarily trying to avoid it, but Bill Schuette back in the news. And over the weekend, Simon, we've had some unedited video of what transpired at his house with the protesters. And we do now have some video evidence that they were banging on the house.
Yeah, certainly. And when this whole thing initially went down, there was wildly conflicting reports, essentially almost two opposite press releases from each side saying one thing or the other. But now that they've released a 12-minute unabridged video, it's given us some more insight onto the alleged siege that's taken place on the Schuette homestead.
You didn't see any banging on the windows, but we did see some banging on the doors.
Yeah, definitely. They definitely did not stay on the sidewalk.
You know, even the small little snippets that they did show, it was pretty clear that they were parading on this guy's lawn, which I can't believe didn't yield some kind of, I don't know, trespassing or some kind of charge, right?
Well, I don't know if there's charges, but I mean, the police were out there, and I think they broke it up from what I heard.
There should have been charges.
Why so?
Because it's his home, for one, and because Mrs. Schuette had nothing to do with the Enbridge pipeline. And because it's bogue.
You know, why the home rather than the Menin building where the Attorney General's office is?
Make a good point. Or even if you stay on his street, you know, and boo and hoo and protest as he's driving out of his driveway, but you don't go up to the house. I just don't think that's appropriate.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it's also important to consider that this organization, Michigan Cats, which has a very interesting URL, by the way, and misleading, michigancats.org. But despite being, they're an environmental activist group. They specialize in direct action. What they do is they put themselves in the spotlight in ways that might be seem inappropriate or offensive to some people. And then, you know, and when they do get arrested, they intend to, and they enter the situation willingly believing that they will.
So maybe it was conscious that they didn't get any kind of arrest because then that would have created the attention and would have prolonged the story, maybe?
Yeah, a question from that the group can consider is, so obviously this was a chance for them to get that message out about Line 5 and about Schuette's inaction, if they would term it on it. Did the blowback from how they carried out, does that diminish what they were trying to accomplish, or does it enhance what they were trying to push?
And that's a great question, because now if you had charges against the people who scaled his tree and tied the sign up and the person who squirted the chocolate syrup on his driveway, every time there's a court hearing or an arraignment or every time he shows up, then you've got the Line 5 issue repeated.
The question is, if they hadn't taken as the tactics they did, which invoked that response in the AG, would they have gotten as much publicity if it had just been a on-the-sidewalk protest that lasted, you know, however many minutes?
And if they had just behaved themselves, then who would have covered it?
I don't know.
I don't know if we would have.
I mean, it definitely got a lot of play, even from the Detroit papers, this event that happened in Midland. So.
Yeah, and I think that what's important is I think they did achieve their aims here, which is they're framing the debate in a different way. I mean, until now, Schuette on Line 5 has been saying, yeah, I think it's an issue. I think it's something that we should address and like something that we should be able to monitor more closely. But he hasn't really proposed anything that's a direct action. But by these protests coming into his home and really bringing it into Schuette's face, whether he likes it or not, they essentially frame the argument as this is something that is in the interest of the state of Michigan, and that the Attorney General, who purports to represent the interests of the state of Michigan, by not doing that, he's failing us.
Abby, should they just go ahead and just drop this whole issue, the Midland police, or should they hunt these people down and start handing out trespassing tickets?
Obviously, the police are going to put forward a little bit more effort to go and find people, if that's what you're asking, that are connected to something against the Attorney General than an average person, just because of the nature of his job. But I do want to return to this publicity and location choice.
Okay.
I think they chose his home for the simple reason that if they had chosen a state building, they would have been in a lot more trouble a lot quicker. So I think there's sort of an ethical problem or consideration here of putting your issue front and center and getting all of this attention, does that come at the cost of trespassing into somebody's home? You know, I mean, why not? My guess is you don't want to choose a state building because you're going to tangle with the Michigan State Police a lot faster.
I mean, if you're going to try and deface the Capitol or try and deface a state building, I could see that. Or if you're going to cause a disturbance out in front and try and run over the security guard and try and go up the seventh floor of the G. Mann and Williams building, Yeah, I mean, I guess that's possible. But does this hurt the cause, John? The Line 5 cause by being socially disruptive? And the minds of voters and the people out there, do they now scratch their head and say, who are these folks?
I think to a certain degree it does for the organization. I don't know if it does to the issue. The Line 5 issue has got appeal in and of itself. The argument that we shouldn't be pumping oil under the straits makes a lot of sense, just from a logical sense. But this group kind of taking it to the doorstep of the Schuette household, I think they just damage their own reputation more than they damage the issue.
All right. Well, let's change gears here a little bit. We're going to move on to Cleveland and talk about the Republican Party is starting to lay the groundwork for next week's convention. One of the issues on the table is whether they should unbind the delegates and let delegates vote as they wish. Wendy Day is the former head of the Michigan campaign for Ted Cruz, and she's leading this effort. Any thoughts here, guys, on if this is really something to just keep us occupied for a week, or is this just a legitimate attempt to get somebody other than Trump to head the Republican ballot?
Well, they need 28 votes on Thursday during the Rules Committee to unbind the delegates, or to get a minority report to take the issue to the floor of the convention for a vote. I don't think they have the votes to actually change the rules. Their other way that people can protest the convention is they can abstain from voting. Then the chair of the convention has to rule whether they'll be allowed to abstain. There's a total of three different approaches these anti-Trump folks can take in the actual convention. So,
there's also an initiative, I believe, in one of the other platforms to allow the delegates to choose a vice president, considering the amount of speculation that's come about.
Okay, so Abby, who are these people who are trying to burn the house down for Donald Trump?
I think we're talking about consultants here trying to hold on to their jobs in the industry of governing.
What do you mean? You mean there's some money that could be possibly made here?
There's always money to be made if you're creative enough to make yourself useful. But, I want to be careful how far we take this argument, because the Tea Party, right, was the same anti-establishment type movement in 2010. And it's been institutionalized by consultants. Whoever carries, the media day basically ends up, people want to capitalize on whatever's popular, whatever's trendy, whatever's grabbing a lot of attention. I don't think you can peg consultants as one side of this argument or the other.
Yeah, but there are a lot of consultants who did not win in this Republican mm-hmm. primary. I mean, the traditional campaign did not win this time. And so I think there's a lot of Republicans who are kind of scratching their heads here a little bit.
Trying
like, gee whiz, we kind of blew this.
Try to recover their money and their losses from... you had a lot of big names working in these, working for these establishment-type candidates that are no longer have a job.
Who thought there's no way Donald Trump could win, and I guess here we are.
Joining me on the other end of the line is the head of the Donald Trump campaign operation in the state of Michigan. He is Scott Hagerstrom. Thanks for joining us on the phone from Cleveland, Scott.
Well, great. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
So obviously there's a lot of hubbub here nationally as the platform committee is meeting in Cleveland. From your perspective and from what you're seeing there, just give our listeners a little update about who is representing Michigan on this platform committee and what they're deciding.
Sure. The platform committee convened last night, and they broke off into subcommittees this morning. And State Senator Joe Hume and Nishan Maddock are representing the Michigan Republican Party on the platform committee. And each state has two people in the territories. So there's a little over 100 people that are meeting, and they're discussing various aspects, amending the Republican platform, and just building a stronger document.
Now, there are four committees that are meeting here at the Republican National Convention before the convention next week. And we also have the Rules Committee, we have the Credentialing Committee, and we have a committee that you're also sitting on.
That is correct, yes, permanent arrangement.
Tell our listeners why these are important committees to be meeting right now.
Well, a lot of decisions are being made. Platform Committee is going to, basically put forth, what the Republican Party stands for, position it takes on issues. And oftentimes, in political debate and in the media, especially national media, things are broken down into sound bites. But if you really look at the platform, there's really a lot of nuances about a lot of different issues. So they're going through the amendments, they're going through the language that was there from 2012, and updating the language, improving the language, and adjusting based on circumstances and things that are going on around us and new challenges. The Rules Committee decides the rules that will govern the Republican Party and how we proceed. And you know, things like, you know, I think one rule that they put in 4 years ago was, you know, you need to win at least 8 states to get your name and nomination. So that'll be a rule, you know, that they could change, they could amend. And then credentials committee, you have fights over who, you know, did someone really a delegate? Did they get elected properly? And you have challenges to that that go on in different states. And we see national news about the challenge of credentials, for example, in the Virgin Islands. And so if challenges are brought forward, if, you know, they can be withdrawn, but if they go forward, they'll be decided by the credentials committee. And then permanent arrangements is more of the logistics. And, you know, if Speaker Ryan was to decide not to chair the convention, then that would be one of the things that that committee would decide, who would be the chair of the convention.
Well, let's talk about one of the big issues right now, and this is having to do with the delegates and unbinding the delegates from supporting Donald Trump. There's some talk about making this a free-flowing convention where no delegate is bound to anybody. What are the chances of something like that happening?
They're very, very low. You know, there's a few individuals that want to ignore the will of the people. It would really make moot all the primary elections that went on around the country and in Michigan, ignore the will of nearly 14 million people. So, and would fly in the face of many states, you know, state party rules, and sometimes even state law. So that is something that there's a group of people pushing. In particular, out of Michigan's 59 delegates, there's two individuals that are on board with that movement. And, you know, that will play out in the Rules Committee later this week. And for the most part, though, that's a very small movement. I think, you know, it gives some people something to talk about. But at the end of the day, we don't see that going anywhere.
Who are the two people in Michigan's delegation who are pushing this?
That's Wendy Day and Barb Bookover.
Now, as given a chance of 1 in 100, 100 being extremely possible, 1 being impossible, where do you put this as a potential that this goes anywhere?
1.5 out of 100.
And then... Is this primarily then being, you mentioned Wendy Day, and I know she was a big Ted Cruz supporter. She was kind of the head of his operation here in Michigan. So is this being pushed by folks who supported Ted Cruz, or are these consultants looking to make a buck? How would you describe the people who are pushing this unbinding of the delegates?
There's a gentleman by the name of Curley, is a delegate from Out West, who's been talking about this for many years, but it never gained traction. What I see is there are some people that are consultants on the national stage that are pushing this. It does appear to be mostly Cruz people, which I find very interesting because they have no solution, no alternate. They want delegates to be able to vote their conscience. They want to put forth a different nominee, but they don't have any solution of who that would be. And I find it interesting that a lot of these people that are pushing this are conservatives, but what they could end up having is a candidate more of a mainstream establishment candidate. But so they sort of want to blow up the system, but they have no solution what comes after they do that.
And if they blow up the institution, what they may end up with is worse than what they had before.
In their opinion, what they believe is worse. But the fact is, you know, Donald Trump won nearly 14 million votes, a record, and well over 1,500 delegates, which is 25% more than what he needed to secure the nomination.
Before you went to Cleveland, there were some town hall kind of gatherings across the state in which you gathered some input regarding the upcoming election and Donald Trump's presumed nomination. What was some of the feedback that you gathered through these gatherings? What are the people telling you?
We see people are very united. Moving forward, it really echoes a lot of the same message that Donald Trump is speaking to in taking back our country, making America great again, and improving our economy, fighting terrorism, and, you know, of course, issues of immigration.
One of the things that I've heard just from talking with regular voters is they're concerned about Donald Trump's temperament and that he says stupid things. When sure. you hear that kind of feedback, what's your response?
Americans are it's a double-edged sword. You know, people want to nitpick, but they also don't want what I would sort of call the Stepford politician, sort of the person that's poll tested. Everything they say, they come across very smooth. They're not real. And
kind of like Mitt Romney.
Well, I use the Stepford analogy to the movie, the Stepford Wives.
Oh, okay.
But you mentioned Mitt Romney, and I think, you know, Donald Trump is very real. And he, what you see is what you get. I think with most politicians, you get a glossed over version, and you don't know who the real person is. You don't see behind the curtain. But with Donald Trump, you know, it's all out there. And there's nothing that he's hiding, unlike, you know, people like Hillary Clinton.
Now, what is your official position then in Michigan?
I'm the state director for the Donald Trump campaign.
Okay, and is that a paid position?
Yes, I'm on staff. Yes.
Okay. And what kind of ground operation does he have in Michigan?
Well, we're working closely with the RNC and state party, and we're working hand-in-hand with them. And we have, right now we have 4 full-time employees in Michigan for the campaign. But, you know, RNC has, I believe, about 35 and then another 7 from state party. So, you know, we're close to 50 people in Michigan operating with the goal of winning the state and putting it in the Republican column.
And one more question here before I let you go, Scott. And how do you get Republicans by November to support Donald Trump and go out and vote for him? Because some of the feedback I hear from Republicans is, you know what, we're just not interested in right now in voting Republican. How do you get these people excited about Donald Trump?
Well, I think when you look at actual polling, we're doing much better with Republicans than Hillary's doing with Democrats. I know a poll just came out. I know it's national, but 56% of Americans believe she should have been indicted for her email scandal. So, you know, people come around. There were 17 candidates. It takes time, but I think when people realize the consequences, you know, you have a Supreme Court vacancy that needs to be filled. You have possible retirements of Kennedy and Thomas. So there could be 3 appointments that take place right away by the next president, and that will mean control of the court for either a strict constructionist or those that legislate from the bench, depending on who's elected president. And I think that's a major issue to bring Republicans on board. And I think once the picture's painted to them of the consequences of a Hillary Clinton presidency, we'll have close to 100% support from Republicans.
Scott Hagerstrom, he's the state director of the Donald Trump campaign here in the state of Michigan. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Great. Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to the crew here, Scott Hagerstrom, for giving us a report here from Cleveland. Simon's going to be hurriedly trying to fix the TV here to get some Tour de France coverage. You weren't very successful, were you?
No, you know, I'm a little bit disgusted that NBC Sports will only provide me with 15-minute-long highlights of each stage. These are 5-hour-long races.
Well, you think that NBC Sports should show the whole 5-hour race?
No, but I would like at least the last 15 to 20 kilometers.
Don't they stream it somewhere?
Oh, yeah, you can find them online, but, you know, I want to present it to the coworkers.
5 hours of Tour de France?
Maybe not the full 5, but at least the last half.
Simon, you're going to have to, before you make your appeal to NBC Sports, you need to convert those kilometers into miles, since I think they're an American-based company.
Can you text me when we're down to 10 minutes left?
Will do.
Well, how about 5? And that's only if it's competitive.
Actually, 2 minutes would be sufficient.
Is it any fun to even watch them cross the finish line? I mean, like, how far apart are they? All right. Simon looks like this
You'll
is
see.
Riveting.
I think John only wants to see the bike crashes. Is that true?
Yeah. Edit out just the bike crashes. And I want to see the finish line. That's it.
Okay. Well, some of the scenery would be cool. Are they going through the mountains yet?
They do. And they have really nice flybys, helicopter flyovers of all the French countryside with a lot of little, like, you know, tourist trivia about different landmarks that they pass on the way.
It sounds like a 1-hour special to me, though, with all the recap and everything. Okay, well, you guys can watch that after you've now tuned off now to the podcast, as that's going to do it as Talking Heads takes us out. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.